The Archbishop of Detroit fires three Orthodox professors at his diocesan seminary. What was their offense? Moral theologian and former professor at that seminary, Dr. Janet Smith, sounds off. Another massacre at a Catholic church in Congo. Dr. Walid Farah shares what's really happening. And Archbishop of San Francisco, Salvatore Corleone, is here to tell us about the Pontifical High Mass he'll be celebrating at the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe. A world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. As always, an important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Detroit Archbishop Edward Weisenberger, already enmeshed in controversy over his restrictions of the traditional Latin Mass, is back in the headlines after unexpectedly firing three long-serving professors at his diocesan seminary. As yet, no statement has been issued by the Archdiocese to explain the dismissals of theology professors Ralph Martin, Eduardo Echevarria, and noted canonist Ed Peters. Here to weigh in is the retired professor of moral theology at the Sacred Heart Major Seminary in the Archdiocese of Detroit, Dr. Janet Smith. Janet, thank you for being here. As I mentioned, on July 23rd, Archbishop Weisenberger of Detroit sacked these three gentlemen from the seminary. Ralph Martin, of course, is the host of The Choices We Face on EWTN. He's appeared on the network for decades. Then last Friday, Dr. Ed Peters, the canon lawyer, the esteemed canon lawyer at the seminary, announced that he, too, had been terminated. Janet, your thoughts on this situation, and what did you think when you first heard the news?
Oh, I did think it was a kind of a purge. These are three of the most distinguished seminary professors in the United States. And it's got to be intended to send a signal to the rest of the seminaries, which is that, I mean, no reason was given for any one of them. But it certainly isn't hard to figure it out. I mean, every news report that talks about it goes right to the reality that all three of them have questioned Pope Francis in some way. And that seems to be a criminal offense, a capital offense. they do it, as I say, most reluctantly. They are not firebrand type people.
They are not.
No, not a bit. And they do so with in their usual way, with great precision and delicacy. Yeah. And it's not a bit overblown or sensationalist. I say it's their responsibility. I say it's their responsibility as leading thinkers, moral theologians at a seminary. That's important. They're teaching young men who are themselves have questions. Their parishioners are going to have questions. You know, what does the church teach? The Holy Father says this, the Catechism says that. They have to say something.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, all three of these men, they have raised questions about Pope Francis in the past for what they described as theologically ambiguous or even misleading public statements. Now, supporters of the Archbishop's decisions, they say these three professors had it coming, and the dismissals were long overdue because they dared to, quote, criticize the magisterial teaching of Pope Francis. What would you say?
Well, I would say in any other pontificate, they would be called upon to adjudicate any such dispute. That's the kind of men they are. If there's a question about what the church's teaching is on capital punishment, it would not be surprising, particularly with Ed Peters, that you go to this person, you say, how him, and say, does this line up with church teaching? I mean, these are the men that would be called upon at any point to give imprimaturs for any books that are published. I mean, they were hired at the seminary precisely to do the kind of work they are doing, Detroit Seminary does not have a great reputation long term in the last couple decades, yes, but they were hired precisely to return Sacred Heart to fidelity. Their fidelity and their prominence, their expertise has been recognized in many ways. Ed Peters is the first layperson, the first American layperson to be appointed to the Apostolic Signatura, which is it's like the Supreme Court in the church in respect to canon law. You can't go any higher. All right. Ed Peters was appointed for that and served at that. Ralph Martin has been on the Pontifical Council for the New Evangelization, right? And Ed Echevarria has been on countless commissions of mostly a voluntary kind, but he's a very expert ecumenist, all right? And these are precisely the areas that the church is most interested in having scholars attend to. If they find ambiguities in Holy Father, they're there.
Yeah, Dr. Smith, I thought the Synodal Church was all about asking questions, but I guess one's forbidden to ask why this was licit and moral for decades and normal, even for centuries, and it's now illegal or forbidden. I mean, I guess academic inquiry, conversation, synodality is out in Detroit.
Oh, it certainly seems to be the case, and it doesn't seem to be the case that there was any conversation with the board or with the bishops of Michigan. Even any inquiry among the faculty or the students, did we find it disturbing what they're doing? These men are extremely brave, and they do what they do in the service of the church. This is not any promotion of their ego or clickbait, because they don't have that in their lives. They are trying to help people understand the church's teaching. One would hope that in a certain sense, men with their pedigrees, with their recognition by the church for their expertise and fidelity, that they'd be untouchable. This is meant to send a signal to all seminary professors across the United States that do not, they aren't dissenters by any stretch of the imagination. They are simply trying to press for clarity on these issues, which people want, need.
Yeah, Dr. Smith, I mean, as you rightly say, none of these men are flamethrowers or, you know, questioning that Pope Francis was the Pope or not. I mean, these were not inflammatory types. These are scholars who, by and large, were simply saying, wait a minute, does this comport with everything we've been taught, not only through the popes in our lifetimes, but those who preceded them? Now, those are legitimate questions. The Pope has to line up with the magisterium of the church, not the other way around. And I think that was the overarching message here that some find threatening, I guess. But Weisenberger was just installed, the new Archbishop of Detroit, in March. Previous to that, he served as the Bishop of Tucson, Arizona, for a little over 7 years. What do we know of his style and ministry in Arizona? Do you know anything about that tenure?
Well, some people are telling me that he fired a lot of people, and he fired a lot of lay people. You know, he has a very openness to LGBTQ issues in ways that seem to be in conflict with church teaching has been. And so, I mean, you mentioned that, I've said this on other interviews, but all of these men had to take an oath of fidelity. And in their oath of fidelity, it said that they were supposed to be in harmony with a local bishop, but it also says, of course, that they have to take a pledge to defend the deposit of the faith. All right, defend the deposit of the faith. Now, a couple years ago, long before Strickland was removed, but when he was starting to be controversial, we talked, and he showed me what he was meant to, what he needed to pledge, and what he did pledge when he became bishop, which was to support the Holy Father and to defend the deposit of the faith. And he said to me, "What am I supposed to do if these are in conflict?" And, you know, we talked about it, and I said, "Well, my understanding is the reason that the Catholic Church has a pope is to defend the deposit of the faith." And so the pope is in service of the deposit of the faith. So you say, what's my priority? You say, it's really one in the same. You're supporting the Pope, the papacy, the office of the Holy Father. If you ask for clarity about anything that he has said that seems to be in conflict with the deposit of the faith.
Hmm. Yeah, Janet, I guess a bishop can summarily dismiss whomever he chooses without the courtesy of an explanation, which was not furnished in this case. But my question is, why are there non-disclosure agreements in force among seminary faculty? Well, I mean, we're hearing that some, if not all, of these men are considering possibly undertaking a legal response. First of all, your thought on the non-disclosure agreements.
Well, yes, I mean, it's outrageous. If you've got good reasons, you give them. I mean, we keep saying that the church is going to be a transparent church, and we're not going to act in any kind of, again, non-synodal and any kind of a tyrannical way. And you're looking at this and you're saying they're suddenly called in. There is nothing in their record in the over 20 years that all of them have served that they've ever been questioned that what they're doing is inappropriate, wrong, whatever. They get called in and they aren't asked to resign. They aren't asked to take retirement. And virtually all of them are retirement age. No, they're told like a Donald Trump show. You're fired. You know, it's just like there's no respect for the dignity and service. I mean, if this were like, the U.S. government, they should be receiving a congressional or presidential medal of honor for the service that they've done. Now, you said reasons don't need to be given. But actually, in the faculty handbook, it says the dismissal must be delivered in written form with reasons for dismissal given. Neither one of those were done. So if they're considering an appeal, then grounds for an appeal. Another faculty member was summarily dismissed like this. And some of us, this was quite a few years ago, and three fellow faculty members got together and went to bat for this man and showed that he was not treated in accord with the norms of the faculty handbook. And he was restored to his position at the seminary. So there's some reason to hope that justice might be done.
Dr. Smith, you retired from the faculty at Sacred Heart some years ago. What was the atmosphere like there during your years of service? And what, if anything, are you hearing now?
Well, let me answer the second one first. I mean, the faculty are incredibly demoralized and frightened. I mean, that's the purpose of this kind of an act.
Right.
They are all concerned that they're next, you know, and if they have said or are about to say anything that's remotely critical of Pope Francis, they are next. And the interesting thing to me is several have already been approached about taking employment at other universities and even seminaries. These are the people who weren't fired, all right, saying, we too have a suspicion that you're going to be next or may be on the list somewhere. We know how talented you are. We'd love to have you at our university. The students are totally perplexed. I mean, these three men are so distinguished. And you're thinking, oh, my gosh, what did they do wrong? Now, my view for some time has been that seminaries are repressive places from the start for these poor young men that come in. And they're basically told to stay in your lane, keep your head down, don't rock the boat, don't challenge anything. You need to go along to get along, or however that expression is. And so they're already afraid they might be doing something wrong that will get them kicked out of the seminary. So in the classroom, I mean, most of us tried to, you know, allow a lot of questioning, certainly of church teaching, et cetera, because how do you get at the answers? And how will they deal with parishioners come up and say, why does the church not allow marriages for same-sex couples? Well, you have to go through the reasons. You have to go through everything. Mm-hmm. So I would say, and Sacred Heart's not, I mean, that's the norm at seminaries. It has been for decades anyway. I don't know if always. But I would say that one of the reasons I took retirement, I had never thought about retirement. You know, you never think you're old and you never think you're going to quit. You just think you're going to go along. And I would say one reason I considered retirement is I found myself always saying in class, have I said this before? Have I said this before? Because I had, of course, but had I said it in this classroom? But that was when the whole McCarrick situation exploded. And I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated by that because, when the scandal emerged in the early part of the 2000s, with the Dallas Charter and everything, I had known that there had been homosexual abuse in the priesthood. Of course, that focused on pedophilia. And I thought, oh, my gosh, if I know about these things, surely the bishops do. And surely they're doing something about it. And then with the McCarrick case, it became clear to me they knew and they weren't doing anything. And even worse, as it's gotten worse over time, my belief that it's a widespread problem among the episcopacy, and that's why they don't do anything about it. Well, I started writing about this and talking about this, and I was very conflicted, again, about my place in the seminary. I mean, do I belong in a seminary when I'm becoming a major critic of the bishops for their moral lives and for their cover-up. And I talked to the students, and they were so grateful because they said nobody else would talk to them about it. And they even gave me a standing ovation after one time I spoke with them. And I actually went and reported myself to the academic dean, and I said, I just want you to know what I did in the classroom, but well, go careful, be easy. You know, I said, these guys, they're men. They're not children. They follow things on the internet. They need people to help straighten out what's going on. But at any rate, it became too conflicted for me. I was ready for retirement, that's for sure. But it was just another reason to move on.
Yeah.
To buy myself freedom.
I want to move on to something else. We all heard the horrifying news this week about the recent massacre of Catholics at that church in the Democratic Republic of Congo near the border of Uganda. Now, I know you're very involved in outreach to Uganda in support of the seminarians and priestly formation there. I'm going to get into the geopolitics of all of this with Dr. Ferris later. But there's a growing number of Catholics and Christians in Africa, Dr. Smith. But these Islamist attacks on Christians continue to rise. What's the greatest challenge facing the church in Africa, in your opinion?
Well, certainly that. I mean, you look at Nigeria and elsewhere, it's just this incredible disappearance of priests and killing of priests. But I have to say, Uganda was, I spent 3 weeks there 2 years ago speaking to five seminaries, actually six, to about 1,750 seminarians. It was incredible. The Ugandans understand their martyrdom more as a witness to their faith. But I read a book about the martyrs, and I was just astounded. Those young men could not be baptized until 2 years after they had a two-year catechumenate program. But part of their formation was very much, you need to be willing to die for your faith. That's what they had to pledge to when they're getting baptized. Now, these are, you know, adult young men, really. They're in their late teens, early 20s, and they were prepared. They were prepared for that. And that spirit, I think, permeates a great deal of the African mentality. If you're a, and we've seen it with a lot of these responses to the Muslims killing priests in Nigeria, they're ready for martyrdom. And we're not, of course. We think it's just something somebody else some other time had to face. But they do. And so that faith is so strong there.
Yeah, well, because the threat is apparent and you know, your life is threatened all the time for simply expressing your faith, which we take for granted here in the United States and parts of Western Europe. Before we run out of time, July 25th is the 57th anniversary of the release of Humanae Vitae, Paul VI's landmark encyclical, which famously stated the church's position against artificial contraception. Your thoughts on the legacy of that encyclical, and has synodality blunted its impact, Dr. Smith?
Well, it certainly doesn't even get on the agenda. I mean, it's that the church, the hierarchy still seems to think that eventually the church will change its teaching, or at least there's just no way to convince the Catholic faithful to follow this teaching. And we just might as well kind of ignore it, in which they've done. What's pleased me is that it seems I've very much curtailed my speaking on that issue because I'm so involved in working with victims of the sex abuse crisis. But I don't feel that so many people seem to have taken up the cudgel. There are just many young women who are out there speaking about this, promoting it. It's no longer one or two voices. It's gotten to be there really is a kind of a movement. And especially mm-hmm. it goes right along with the growth of the TLM. People who attend the Latin Mass, 99% accept the church's teaching on contraception. And again, you go to these masses and they're just packed with young people having large families. And for them, it's just, it's a kind of martyrdom, of course, in our culture. Nobody thinks you can do it. There's not enough money. Nobody thinks you can do it because it's so demanding on you. It requires so much self-sacrifice to be the parent of a large family, almost as much as it does, and maybe more so than joining a religious order. So nobody makes your meals for you. Let's put it that way. And you've got... So it's nobody takes care of your car, et cetera, et cetera. So
that's true. So
I'm really pleased. And there's more and more data out there. I mean, when I started speaking on this in the early 90s and then in the mid late 90s, all this information about the impact of the hormones on a woman's system in every respect, it just kept burgeoning and nobody seemed to know about it. And now it's become highly women are wary of the pill. So it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Dr. Janet Smith, we will leave it there. Thank you for the time and insight. And you can get more information on Janet Smith's website at janetsmith.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
On July 27th, radical Islamic terrorists struck a Catholic church holding an evening mass in the Democratic Republic of Congo. At least 43 faithful were murdered with machetes and gunfire during the overnight vigil. ISIL is claiming responsibility, saying they're spreading the global Islamic caliphate. With analysis of this story and more, I'm joined by foreign policy analyst, co-host of the War and Freedom podcast, Dr. Waleed Faris. Waleed, condemnations of these heinous acts are coming in from all over the world. Pope Leo released a statement in which he said, quote, "As I entrust the victims to God's loving mercy, I pray for the injured and for Christians around the world who continue to suffer violence and persecution, urging all those with local and international responsibility to collaborate in order to prevent such tragedies." Waleed, how has the local government in the DRC responded? And what do you make of this increasing wave of violence coming from these radical Islamists?
Absolutely. I mean, let me go by graduation. Number one, the actual action, bloodshed against a Catholic church in the middle of Africa, that's almost South Africa, is by itself horrifying. And as you just said, not just the Catholic Church, all other churches and moderate Muslims and people with no faith have been really criticizing and have been shocked by what has happened there. But the second thing is the location. ISIS operates in Syria, sometimes in Afghanistan, all the way to Libya. But this is very far from their grounds. What it tells us, unfortunately, it happened with the church, but it could happen with other population and communities, is that ISIS and the jihadists in general over the past maybe few months, I would say maximum a year, but certainly we haven't seen it that far, are attacking Christian communities and other communities as far as Zaire or the Republic, the Democratic Republic. You asked me about the government. Well, the government there and many countries around Congo are very weak. And that's why we expect that once they discover our weakness, the national security weakness, they may do more.
Father Marcelo Oliveira, a Comboni missionary who's been in the Congo for many years, told Aid to the Church in Need that the victims were part of a movement called the Eucharistic Crusade. They were participating in this prayer vigil as part of the summer holiday formation season. Waleed, are groups like this, Catholic groups in particular, being targeted by ISIL, or is this just part of an overall bid for domination in the region against all faiths?
For both, Raymond, we've seen them moving against Buddhists, Hindus, Shias, moderate Sunnis, and of course against all kind of Christians, should they be Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, everything. What is not ISIL or ISIS is basically the enemy of that jihadist movement. But certainly any Christian activity, Catholic or not, in Africa or elsewhere, that seems to be progressing and expanding, you know, the missionary activity, are target number one. Missionaries and people associated with it, churches or schools or hospitals, are prime target for jihadist organizations in Africa and around the world.
Yeah. How is this tied to their desire for a caliphate?
That is an act to lead to the caliphate. What they have been doing, and this is since 9/11, and in my case, many, many years before 9/11, this is their strategy, this is their process. First, they target the weakest, which means the Christian minorities. And among the Christian minorities, those who are mostly pro-West and other, you know, other religions as well. But in this case, that's targeting the Christians. And then they try to push for ethnic cleansing. That's what they've done, for example, in Syria. We discussed it last time for the Alawites, for the Druze, not Christian, but minorities. The Christians in the Middle East have been suffering from persecution for decades. I mean, you and I spoke about it exactly 11 years when the ethnic cleansing of Assyrians, Chaldeans, Syriacs, the Copts, the incident in Libya. This is standard jihadi operative strategies. That's what they do. They attack the minorities, they ethnic cleanse them, and then they move against the Muslim moderates and, of course, against the West.
Waleed, who is this Allied Democratic Forces, this ADF, that apparently committed this act? Who are they?
Look, in Africa and Congo and in that region in particular, the jihadists come in two waves. The first wave, they use the local opposition to the government. That's very smart. I mean, it can reflect even in politics in the West. They use the most radical elements on the left or on the right in some cases. But in this case, that is the organization. And they ally themselves against the government, which in principle is aligned with the West. And once they take root, the jihadists themselves, they create a local branch. See, wait a few weeks, wait a few months. There will be an Islamist organization that would claim the struggle and the jihad inside the Congo and the areas I'm concerned about, Angola. I'm concerned about, you know, all these countries around them.
Yeah. I want to move to the Middle East. Religious minorities, as you mentioned, are under attack in Syria. This includes the Druze. The U.S. State Department confirmed last week that a U.S. citizen with dual citizenship was killed in Syria after disturbing videos surfaced showing him among a group of men apparently executed by Syrian government forces. Waleed, why is this violence escalating in Syria, and how can the U.S. help to mitigate it?
The U.S. can do a lot. Actually, the U.S. alone can resolve the problem. They have recognized, I mean, we have recognized this government. We have recognized this president, hoping that he will moderate. We have been advised that eventually those jihadists, if they have money, if they have recognition, they will mute, they'll mutate, they will become normal people. Mm-hmm. That is not the case. This is a result of an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. Yes, there are more practical, pragmatic elements among them than others, but the base of that regime is still connected to Al-Qaeda, to Daesh, to ISIS, to Al-Nusra. So some of these units actually have one specific goal that we just mentioned right now. Get rid of the minorities. They want to get rid of, as I said, I mean, you and I spoke in March already. It's like only 2-3 months about the ethnic cleansing of the Alawites in a very, very horrific way. Villages, women, kids, etc. They are repeating this with the Druze. Now, the Druze are luckier a little bit because they're not that far from Israel. And had it not been the Air Force of the Israelis, and of course, some pressure applied by the United States, that maybe the Druze would have been massacred in much larger numbers. What should happen, and the U.S. can make it happen, is to put pressure on that regime. That regime has just received $7 billion from this consortium with Qatar, with other countries, and with us. We act there almost in a naivete that we are good, everybody is supposed to be good, but they have an agenda. And if you ask me, when do we know that the jihadists have changed and moderated? They should say it. Like Gorbachev said, we are moving from communism to social democracy. A speech. We're not even talking on the action on the ground. What we need to hear from the regime, the jihadi regime in Syria, a speech that says we are abandoning jihadism. It's not, you know, something that you need a miracle for. As long as they have not said that, their intentions are still jihadists, unfortunately, right?
Okay. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said that the UK will recognize a Palestinian state by September unless Israel commits to peace in the Gaza Strip. Waleed, this announcement comes as there's international alarm over growing starvation, deaths in the Gaza Strip. What is your take on this growing movement to recognize the Palestinian state?
It's the, in my view, it's strategically the very wrong way to do it. It's going to escalate with Israel. It's going to allow Hamas and the other jihadists to escalate themselves. They don't want the resolution. It would have been much more positive that the United States, of course, will pressure its allies in the region. That would be Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, UAE mostly, and Jordan. All these countries, they have a problem with the jihadists. They have a problem with Hamas. By the way, I'm glad you asked this question now, because yesterday these moderates at the Arab League said, yeah, we want a two-state solution. We can discuss that.
Yeah.
But we want Hamas to dismember, to remit their weapons. That is the measurement. If Hamas decide to accept the Arab call to disarming, and then we can ask UAE, Egypt, Saudi Arabia to train police people, I think Israel will accept if there is a change of government in Gaza, and that would be the beginning of a new era. What has to do with logistics and, you know, famine and stuff, it's all orchestrated by Hamas. I've seen online cafes open in parts of Gaza. I've been in those situations in Lebanon when the area where I was living, mostly Christian area and Druze area, were surrounded by the Syrian army. Yes, there were killings, but people had stuff because we had an access to the sea. Gaza doesn't have an access to the sea, doesn't have an Arab support yet. When that happened, I think we could see more hope in Gaza.
You saw what the president said. He said it's time for Hamas to simply surrender and for peace to reign here. How is that possible? Will Israel accept just a surrender of Hamas?
They should. Of course, Israelis have their own national security analysis assessment. You know, I've been, you know, analyzing Israeli policies and politics for a long time. The Israeli population wants peace. They want to end this war. Of course, there are elements in Israel that are very concerned after October 7th that they don't trust whomever is going to come. But my answer is this. If you have an alternative to Hamas, you shouldn't worry. But be part of that alternative. And really, it's back to Washington. Our administration, which has been doing great deals all over the world, this is the mother of all deals. They should gather these Arab countries who, by the way, they have listed Hamas. Most of them have listed Hamas as a terrorist organization. We need a better architecture between the United States, our Arab allies, and Israel to end Hamas and immediately bring help, all kind of help. Saudi Arabia alone could financially provide all the help for the entire population of Gaza.
Yeah. Well, it looks like Mike Huckabee and Witkoff are going in, being sent by the president to host some high-level negotiation. Will that bear fruit? I mean, we've heard this before. They've attempted this many times.
I have a view on negotiations because of the experience we had in the Middle East. You push Hamas to the maximum you can. The Arabs have to state that Hamas's role is over. That's crucial for the supporters of Hamas. Once they see the big community, Arab Islamic community, if they are silent, we don't know what they want. But if they say it's over, Hamas, remit your weapons, we are coming in as a police. We will sit with the U.S. and with Israel, of course, because it's already inside Gaza. And then we will provide an alternative. The Palestinian people of Gaza really wants freedom. They want normalization. They want peace. They want food. They want the end of this war in as much as Israel. Everybody in the region wants the end of this and other wars. The way to give a solution here is basically to have a very strong unity between the United States, Arab allies, Israel, to make sure that Hamas understand they have no more allies to count on, to disarm, surrender their weapons. A police force will go in, and that is the way for Gaza's population to survive everything else, because now Saudi Arabia, for example, by itself and the UAE can themselves give a solution for food, logistics, and the beginning of a reconstruction. President Trump has a plan for reconstruction, and the Israelis can't believe until, you know, when they will have peace. So the solution is there. You need an architecture that starts here in Washington, D.C.
Well, you recently wrote, when the jihadists are neutralized in Gaza, the population will be fed in a few weeks, and a new anti-jihadist local government could receive billions from the first to end the regime in Gaza, then to feed Gaza. But Dr. Ferris, what happens if the jihadists are not quickly neutralized? I mean, you can't starve everybody there.
No, of course. What Israel needs is basically a green light from two allies coming at the same time. If it's only the United States, those jihadists will look at the Arab world and the radicals among the Arab world and continue what they call resistance. And that is not a good news, which means that Israel will have to do more. And if Israel does more, then it will appear in the media and in reality as maximum violence. What needs to happen is a coming together of three forces: Arab moderates, the United States, and Israel have a plan. Because usually Hamas, you know, is defeated, but then nothing happened. No ceasefire happened. No replacement force happened. And that's why Hamas comes back. The Sinai should be a staging ground, the Sinai that's inside Egypt, to an Arab force with Palestinians. It's like when the Allies came to France at the, you know, in the landing, they had free French forces with them. There are Palestinians ready to come, or Gazans ready to come back to Gaza. So people think that Hamas can fight till eternity. That's not true. They have been defeated, but they have not been replaced. And they have the power of radically indoctrinating individuals if nobody takes over the schools. The schools should be the
very
first
quickly,
ones, and the police stations should be the second ones.
Yeah, before we run out of time, Border Czar Tom Homan told the press on Wednesday that ICE has arrested over 300 Iranian nationals in recent months, citing them as national security threats. Watch.
70% of everybody arrests is a criminal. Hard stop, 70%. Who's the other 30% we're arresting? National security threats, for instance, over 300 Iranian nationals.
Waleed, we've talked about the porous U.S. border for years. What do we know about these people, and how did they get into the country? Did they just cross over from Mexico?
Absolutely. I mean, from Mexico was what was happening for years. We discussed it so many times. The advantage of what the Trump administration has done was to reduce it from, I don't know, from 100% to maybe 4%. But 4% is huge. Remember that 19 hijackers did what they've done on 9/11. And every attack in the United States was done by one or two persons. 300. If those 300 are really linked to the regime or linked to the jihadists or have in mind even individual attacks, as we saw in Colorado and New York and elsewhere, it is a catastrophe. So now we have passed part of that bridge for safety, but the United States still have a homeland security problem, which going to last probably about 2 years before everything goes back to normal, if any.
Wow. Well, we will leave it there. Waleed Ferris, thank you for being here. And you can, of course, read Dr. Ferris's book, Iran, an Imperialist Republic and U.S. Policy, at bookstores everywhere. Thank you, Waleed.
Thank you for having me.
And this week on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I talked to Emmy, Tony Award-winning actor and philanthropist Gary Sinise. He talks about hearing the call in different seasons of life. And I have an extended commentary on that Sidney Sweeney Good Genes controversy. Take a look.
How did the foundation start? Tell me about the founding. So you're out doing these USO tours with the band. I know you're also collaborating with other organizations that are building homes for veterans and helping veterans in various ways. And you're donating a lot of the money from these concerts to these partner organizations. But when do you start your own foundation? What was the impetus for that?
Well, you know, when I started making those tours, those early tours, just volunteering to go to the hospitals or, you know, go shake hands or something, or you know, now take the band and go play on military bases and whatnot. One of the things that I also wanted to do was to try to help more people, was to volunteer for a lot of different other organizations. Mm. There were a lot of service organizations out there that were supporting veterans and first responders. And I wanted to help veterans and first responders. So I would volunteer to, you know, raise money for these organizations, raise awareness for what they were doing by doing PSAs or whatever. Huh. So I just started volunteering wherever I could for multiple organizations. So I learned a lot about all these different needs and organizations were filling this need, you know. You know, we were building homes for our wounded. We were taking care of our Gold Star children, our families of our fallen, entertainment, you know, whatever it was. It was a lot of different things. And I supported a lot of different organizations. After doing that for, you know, 10 years or whatever it was clear that this was something that was just a big part of my life. And I started thinking, well, you know, I've got to find a way to do this in a different way. And I've seen all these nonprofits pop up, and I've tried to help them all. Why don't I just start my own? Mm-hmm. And at that point, I had been doing it long enough that I had a pretty good reputation with, you know, trying to help. And so that's why I put my name on the foundation. I called it the Gary Sinise Foundation, because there was already a... You know, I already had a relationship with the military
all
community.
All these veteran families,
And I had been raising money for all these other organizations. I was on television, you know, weekly, and CSI New York. So I just said, let's do it. I want to do more. And I think the way to do that is to start raising our own money so that I can hire people to do more. So we started out very small, a couple of people, and now we've got a giant organization now.
Yeah, give me a sense, and I won't make you go through every program, but you all do things that I don't see other organizations doing. Years ago, I know you took over the Snowball Express program. Tell me about that. I mean, I've covered it. It's one of the most moving and I think amazing and important moments at Christmas time, I think, of almost any organization in the country.
It's beautiful. It's focused on the children of our fallen heroes. And it was started at Disneyland in 2006 by a group of folks that just wanted to help the kids of our fallen heroes and help them through the holidays by taking them to a happy place like Disneyland and letting them play and letting them meet each other to see that they weren't alone, you know, in their grief and what they were going through. There's a lot of other kids that have lost a parent in military service. And it was very bonding and healing. I got involved with it the second year. They had done one event at Disneyland. I was shooting CSI New York in Studio City. They contacted me and said they wanted to come and show me a video of their first event. And I saw that. I said I wanted to be involved. I volunteered to donate my band the following year to come play for the kids. I did that. Then I went back the next year. Then I donated and just kept doing it every year, helping to raise money or raise awareness or raise spirits by bringing the band and playing for the kids. I've done it, you know, I don't know. We're in our 18th year
now. Yeah, I know, it's wild.
Snowball's in its 18th year.
The entire Arroyo Grande Show is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts. I am a podcast, too. Spotify, Apple, iHeart, it's all there. Be sure to check it out. Subscribe so you don't miss an Arroyo Grande Show. And we have a brand new installment of the Prayerful Posse. Father Gerald Murray riding solo this week. We get into the blossoming financial scandal at the Vatican and more. That drops Friday. Visit RaymondArroyo.com. for all those links. Cardinal Raymond Burke, Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe in La Crosse, Wisconsin, celebrates its 17th anniversary this week. And on Tuesday, August 5th, my next guest will preside at a solemn pontifical mass at the shrine, a traditional Latin mass. Here to tell us about it and its significance is the Archbishop of San Francisco,
Salvatore Corleone. Archbishop, thank you for being here. Before we talk about the Mass, I want to get your reaction to the news that just broke that Pope Leo is going to declare St. John Henry Newman a doctor of the Church. Your reaction to this, and what should his title be? They're holding that in reserve, I guess, until the big moment.
This is something the U.S. bishops have supported. We did take a vote of our the full body of bishops and are supportive of declaring him a doctor of the Church. Of course, he's called the invisible father of the Second Vatican Council, so he's very had great foresight into the role of the consultation of the lay faithful, and but in a way that is consistent with the Church's tradition and how the magisterium of the Church works. So I think this is a great step forward for us.
Yeah. What do you make, and we're seeing report after report of this, and considering that you're now celebrating this Latin Mass, and it's going to be an important one, I think, because of its national prominence, but there are a rash of continuing clampdowns on the traditional Latin Mass across the country. I know in May you expressed your hope for the restoration of Pope Benedict's Summorum Pontificum, which allowed the free celebration of the ancient rite. What do you think will happen now, particularly now that we have a new pope?
I'm very inspired and encouraged by Pope Leo's vision and modeling of unity. He understands the need for unity, given the situation it came from in Peru, is his understanding of church governance. So I think we're in a very good position to try to build up greater unity in the Church. I can't help but believe that he understands that marginalizing people for the way they want to worship is not going to build up unity. It will only cause further divisions. On the other hand, I don't think he believes the correct approach is an equal and opposite reaction. So I think there will be sort of an incremental uniting of the whole family of God here. And I think there will be a relaxation in some way or another for people to have access to the traditional Mass.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's happy news for a lot of people watching. Look, Archbishop, as I travel the country, you go and see these traditional Latin communities, whether, you know, I'm on my way into a Novus Ordo Mass and you see crowds coming out with their children or you know, I visit them as I travel around the country. It's amazing to me the young people that are drawn to this. Why do you think they're drawn in this way to what many thought was a forgotten or should have been a forgotten rite in the minds of some in the Church?
That Mass has different names we use to refer to it as the traditional Latin Mass, the extraordinary form, the Tridentine Mass. The best way to name it, I believe, is the classic form of the Roman Rite. It has developed organically over centuries. And it attains the status of classic. Classic means that it's beautiful and worthy in every age, in every culture, for every generation. So there's no such thing as a new work of art that is a classic. It has to stand the test of time. And I think it has. And people are drawn to that because it has a sense, certain sense of timelessness to it. And then, of course, the beauty and the reverence, which is very uplifting when it is celebrated properly, which I think nowadays most often is. That wasn't always the case in the past. So I think it touches people in sort of an intuitive way that very often, unfortunately, the way the Mass is celebrated today does not. It doesn't mean it has to be celebrated that way. It can also be very inspiring and uplifting, and I've celebrated Novus Ordo Masses that way. But I think they're seeking this sense of timelessness that connects them to something beyond themselves, right? We all have this human desire for transcendence, and I think that Mass helps us to connect with that.
Yeah, Archbishop, you know, as I was listening to you, we've been hearing so much talk of the synodal church, and we have to listen to the people of God, and we have to listen and bring everybody in, totos, totos, totos. When you see so many young people drawn to this Mass, the question I always get is, are the bishops and is the Vatican listening to us?
What I worry about is if they are kind of pushed to the side and marginalized, it will feed into a narrative that they criticize of those who like the traditional mass, which I think is maybe in some cases, but not most cases, that we're the real mm-hmm. Catholics. This is the best way. What people aren't the real Catholics. I don't think most people who worship in who prefer that form of worship believe that. Maybe mm-hmm. some do. But if they're punished that way, it's going to feed that narrative and encourage people who like the traditional mass to think that way. Therefore, it creates more division, which is why I think Pope Leo recognizes that and somehow wants in a coherent kind of incremental way to build up unity among all forms of worship. There are certain ecclesial movements, too, that have ways of worshiping at mass to build up unity among the whole family of God. Yeah.
Well, Archbishop, you and Cardinal Raymond Burke will be celebrating a solemn pontifical mass in the traditional Latin Rite on August 5th, the Solemnity of Our Lady of the Snows. Now, Archbishop, what's the significance of that feast day? And tell us about the connection to the Pope's Basilica, St. Mary Major in Rome.
Yes, well, we know that St. Mary Major is the mother church of all churches dedicated to the Virgin Mother of God. And this Mass is dedicated to her under her two titles of Our Lady of Guadalupe and the Immaculate Conception. So this was the original vision of this Mass. I decided we needed to commit a Mass such as this when I saw back in 2018 we were going to have our archdiocesan-wide celebration of Our Lady of Guadalupe on December 8th. And I thought, again, it's the point, whole point of unity, right? Our patroness in the United States, Holy Day of Obligation for us, celebrating that Mass, Immaculate Conception, in the midst of celebrations to honor Our Lady Guadalupe, patroness of Mexico and all of the Americas, with all the divisions and polarizations and tensions on both sides of the border. We all love Our Lady. She all unites us as a mother into one family of God. So I envision this as being a Mass of unity, using sacred music, but incorporating the sounds and the melodies of the popular songs that Mexican people sing to honor Our Lady of Guadalupe, especially that Himno Guadalupano. And I asked our composer in residence, Baraka, to compose that. Now, as it turns out, it's a Mass of unity in another sense as well. I later asked Frank to adapt it to an extraordinary four Mass as I was requested to celebrate a solemn high pontifical Mass at the Basilica Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, Washington, D.C. So this is another way we seek to build up unity with consistency of the two forms of the Roman Rite. It's the same music. There are some adaptations that are necessary, but it's the same music at both Masses. We had a special set of vestments commissioned for this Mass, the same vestments. Mm. And it draws people who devotion to Our Lady of Guadalupe, to those who are attracted to the more traditional classic form of worship, to people who love their ministry with their Spanish-speaking brothers and sisters. So I see this as, in multiple ways, a Mass that builds up unity within the Church.
Back in May, you were appointed to the newly established Religious Liberty Commission by President Trump in order to protect religious liberty here in the U.S. We saw that recent victory for the Church in Washington State, which protected the sanctity of the Catholic confessional. Was this a concern for the Commission? And what else are you all focused on?
So President Trump formed this Religious Liberty Commission and then three advisory committees, one of which consists of religious leaders. So I'm on the Religious Leaders Advisory Committee to the commission. This is an example, though, of why we need such a commission, these aggressive moves against religious liberty. This is a very reasonable, time-honored practice of respecting the seal of confession. And we see what happens in a highly secularized society that disrespects people's religious beliefs and practices, even though they're time-honored and very reasonable. So apparently in a highly secularized society, there are some groups of people, classes of people that are not accepted as being equal. So, and they're very often religious believers. So we very much need this commission to address these kinds of issues in our country right now.
Well, Archbishop Salvatore Cordileone, we thank you for being here. We will leave it there. For more information on the August 5th Pontifical Mass at the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe in La Crosse, visit guadalupeshrine.org. Archbishop, thank you again.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for this week. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, Thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. I know.